Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J, and for the next half hour, I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. So keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left. I'm speaking today with Glenn McGee. Glenn is the editor of the American Journal of Bioethics, founder and current blogmaster of the blog.bioethics.net, also the Ballant Chair of Medical Ethics at Albany Medical College, and a professor of philosophy, and the chief of the Office of Bioethics for the State of New York, and the director of the Alden March Bioethics Institute, as well as in the last 5-6 years having published a number of books about bioethics, the bestseller The Perfect Baby, A Pragmatic Approach to Genetics, Who Owns Life, Pragmatic Bioethics, The Human Cloning Debate, and most recently, Beyond Genetics. So welcome, Glenn.
Thanks very much.
You're really very productive guy, and you only got your PhD, what, 1996?
94.
Okay. So you've been plugging away and have accomplished so much. And the blog bioethics.net is really a service. It's the only bioethics, it's the principal bioethics blog out there right now.
Well, it's fun, frankly. As you know better than anybody, one of the tough things about a blog in an academic field other than, I mean, blogs have brought out lots of folks in medieval studies and philosophy, and it kind of suits those mediums because there's not a whole lot of questioning about what's your role when you're a scholar. It's just nice to be doing more. In bioethics, oddly, doing a blog puts you at the interstices of a whole bunch of things that people do generally. So I'm always trying to kind of figure out what's the balance here. It's nice to have it be a little bit funny, but its role really is to cover things in a field where stuff changes every day, and yeah, how critical do you be? This blog comes out of an academic journal, so anyway, it's a lot of fun. I like it.
Well, I heard you recently say that the blog and bioethics in general had gotten a deluge of attention with the Schiavo case.
It was insane. I used to write a column before I started blogging for MSNBC, and I looked at their materials, and they give a regular hit count to the people who write for them, and a former colleague of mine still does. And we were able to determine that we had more hits in one day to bioethics.net than MSNBC had. And that's really saying something. Several million hits in a period of 2 hours. This was a case that was bigger than Dolly. That is, this for bioethics, there's never been a higher level of histrionic media attention in history, I would argue. And it's kind of, in a number of ways, a good test case for whether or not bioethics, both as a group of people writing and thinking about things and then making public comments, and bioethics as an area that theoretically has trained a bunch of people, whether that does any good. I'm actually kind of proud of bioethics. I think we did a good job.
I am too. I mean, I think that this was a real watershed for the waking up of American bioethicists to what the 900-pound gorilla of the Christian right had in mind for all of the careful negotiations that we've worked out over the years. But one of the things that you pointed out most recently in your blog, at blog.bioethics.net, is that this Texas law that Bush had enacted, that there are kids who are being removed from life support in Texas under a law that President Bush enacted while governor.
That's right, and that's the kind of thing that blogs do well. I can't take any kind of credit for that, but it's been the blog traffic that we saw in Schiavo might have been greater than other websites saw, other than perhaps the top two or three blogs out there that do politics regularly. But in the shift that people have kind of bemoaned from rank-and-file news analysis and even up-to-the-minute web news to blogs, there is this incredible fact that people are able to do pretty quick analysis of political problems. And so a couple of things that I'm kind of proud of. One was we were able to post something that John Eisenberg put together about who paid for the Schiavo case. And it was kind of incredible, and it spawned all sorts of news stories about how the conservative right really has created not only an agenda for bioethics, but a plan to pursue it. And the Schiavo case was a you know, that was a play that was run out of a playbook. And acknowledging that and then trying to figure out how to respond to it is going to define bioethics in the next 10 years.
Well, you and I were recently at an event in Washington, the Humanist Bioethics event, where Catherine Hinch from the Women's Bioethics Project had tallied up all the money that the Christian right was pouring into bioethics endeavors, and it was hundreds of millions of dollars at this point, and it's quite scary.
It is. It's terrifying.
So this, I think, this is one of the themes I want to talk to you about, because you've been a close observer and central participant in the American bioethics community. I've been a little bit more on the periphery. And yet it seems that a lot of the issues that American bioethics had considered to be open for, you know, kind of roundhouse debate for many years, that there's been a sea change as this Christian right influence and the Cass Commission has scared a lot of bioethicists about, you know, where things might head, and that there's been a different attitude about the kinds of debates that we need to have. There's been more focus on social justice, more focus on autonomy, and less of a tolerance for yuck factor arguments. Do you think that that's an accurate assessment?
It is. I really have in the past few months begun to feel like I'm the only person who feels the way that I do. There's a chorus of folks in bioethics who are arguing right now that bioethics is near death because of pharma money in the field. So there's lots of folks who are saying these days that the institutions of bioethics can't exist much longer if they keep... There's I think, roughly $200,000 out there for bioethics funding, as opposed to from pharma companies, as opposed to an enormous amount from public granting organizations. And people are properly concerned that that might begin to have some influence. But in bioethics, it's the sky is falling. And meanwhile, across the aisle, funding for a new kind of bioethics that is radically conservative, that sort of thing has become, you know, de rigueur. We expect now to see this enormous intellectual effort in conservative bioethics, and my prediction is that over the next 2 or 3 years, we will see the creation of whole institutions for conservative bioethics that will represent some of the mainstream arguments within bioethics. That is, it will become more common to hear someone arguing, as was argued in this morning, in AP News this morning, that there are wild people out there doing awful things with science, than it is to hear someone have a rational discussion of justice or new technology.
Well, that's very interesting that you say that, because I recently reviewed Wesley J. Smith's latest book, A Consumer's Guide to a Brave New World, and this is one of the arguments that he has trotted out over many years. He started his life as a Naderite attorney and then turned on bioethics and decided that it was the the principal instigator of the culture of death. But he pulls out this argument that all bioethicists are somehow in the pocket of the biotech industry, which, you know, if you asked any biotech industry executive, so you're best friends with bioethics, they would just laugh, because up until this point, most bioethicists have had nothing good to say about biotech, and yet, you know, this argument gets traction somehow. It's really bizarre to me.
It is bizarre, and it's incredibly self-defeating. I mean, yeah, I want to know where my biotech money is. I've been looking for it, and I can't find it. The idea that there's tons of this money out there is wrong. It's really just wrong. We actually did a study in connection with a conference in my institution that was sponsored by the big bioethics national organization called the American Society for Bioethics and the Humanities on what we call the ethics of bioethics. And at this conference, we had lots and lots of people who have a lot of concern about exactly that. And what they say is, as you said, that this money exists and that it's changing things and it'd be really awful. It's exactly what Wesley Smith says. But when you ask them where the money is, you can name 4 or 5 people who have it. Now, I'm as concerned as anyone that the institution of ethics be bought off. But what's incredible is the fear here is of pharma companies, when the only institution that's applied any force at all in bioethics in the last 5 years is the conservative right. And when I say they've applied force, I mean that the biggest conservative think tanks have made bioethics one of their top 3 priorities in almost every case, including some of the best funded foundations, many of them involved not only with things like the Schiavo case, but with the development of agendas for bioethics going forward. I think it is a good time to be kind of worried about bioethics, frankly, because bioethicists are so unself-aware. So you have to see the threat, right?
I'm speaking with Glenn McGee. He's the editor of the American Journal of Bioethics. He's the blog master of blog.bioethics.net. He's a professor of philosophy and medical ethics at Albany Medical College. He's the chief of the Office of Bioethics for the state of New York. Man, your CV's so long, I can't even, you know, reiterate it, but you're the author of many books and publications. Let's talk about the bioethics agenda from the right. One of the folks who attempted to end run, getting stuck in embryo land, as he put it, was Leon Cass. He decided that being the head of the Cass Commission, the President's Bioethics Commission, was not getting him anywhere that he wanted to get. And so he, at the beginning of, I guess, in last fall, he released this bioethics agenda that he wanted to see Congress pass and got slapped around for that a little bit by the Republican congressman. And I think that relates to another of the things that you recently noted in your blog, which is the drug industry funds politicians. Do you think that Cass has been end-run by biocapitalism's influence in Congress, the real biocapitalist influence, not the biocapitalist influence in bioethics?
Well, I think, frankly, that a number of the conservatives who we call on a variety of issues neoconservatives, like Leon Cass, an avowed neoconservative, kind of walk an unusual line. So it is interesting, but it's also telling that Wesley Smith, whom you mentioned, has moved from Naderite worked into the neoconservative right, and it's a move that Leon Cass makes too. So that is in the neoconservative movement on bioethics. There's this general sense and argument that science is getting dangerous. It's problematic. There are some things we shouldn't do, as he puts it, you know, famously. There's a wisdom to repugnance, and these kinds of arguments put together have an impact that the conservative right, well, some of them like it very much. So fundamentalist Christians have been willing to go the distance with Cass when what they really want to argue is that pro-life is the correct position on everything, including stem cells. They end up going the distance. Catholic Church, of course, also gone the distance with Cass in saying that independent of stem cell research, it's also a bad idea to genetically modify embryos and so on for a variety of reasons. But there are a lot of folks who won't go the distance. And so, as you indicated, when the statement came out from Leon Cass lobbying the Congress, it suggested some compromise positions. And they were unusual compromises to try to kind of accomplish a neoconservative purpose. And conservatives have long held the high ground, or rather the strongest ground, on issues like abortion and stem cells, because they've appealed to to their lobby anyway, an uncontroversial, clear position. They say it's wrong to kill. Right? We are pro-life, extend to all organisms the right to live. The Cass position is more complicated, and it's in some ways it's repugnant to those folks because they say that Cass gives too much, that he's too focused on weirdness, and they frankly are concerned about Cass's anti-industry arguments that, you know, don't resonate with the drug industry that's poured hundreds of millions of dollars into the support of Republican members of the House and Senate and to presidential campaigns. So there's that. And then there's another piece here that I think is actually kind of eerie, and that is that Leon Cass's statement, essentially arguing for positions that the Congress should take, was produced not by Professor Cass as chair of the President's Bioethics Advisory Council. In other words, it didn't have their vote, but as he said, as a private citizen. And it wasn't released to the media, or for that matter to anyone else. In fact, it was given very quietly in a confidential way to independent members of Congress. A journalist got a hold of it, and I was able to get a copy and put it up on the internet, and it was kind of propagated somewhat after that. But the statement was never intended to go public, and as a result of it having gone public, Congress actually investigated the chair, Professor Cass, and you know, they've gone quiet about this, but there's no question that there are issues about the way politicians operate in the Bush administration on bioethics. So, I mean, these are significant issues, and I should be clear that in my comments about anything political or, for that matter, about bioethics, I do not speak for the state of New York, but my opinion as a scholar is that we've entered a different era of politics, and I think that's significant for bioethics and for society.
Well, you are appointed by a Republican governor, but a Republican governor who's in the Northeast. And I think one of the things that's interesting that you also comment in your blog about is the splits in the Republican coalition over stem cells. They're beginning to see that these bioethics issues, that they don't want to go the distance with the Christian right, at least the liberal, moderate Republican wing.
Yeah, I think it is the case that states are taking unusual and differing positions on this, and the question of who takes what on as a kind of argument has been different from state to state. I'm not even comfortable. I do not speak for the state of New York, and my appointment was to, you know, the Office of Bioethics is an advisory and educational research kind of body, so I take no positions on behalf of the state, and that's important. I don't think that there could be an Office of Bioethics in a state in the United States that takes positions. It would be very difficult. Some states have had task forces and so on that take positions, but even then, it's complicated. And we've entered an era in bioethics in which the state is suddenly the most important body. We focused for years on the idea that we can change things in life sciences with these presidential commissions, and they don't get anything accomplished at all. The most ineffective mode of action in the history of bioethics, and yet we stick by it. The real action in these new technologies is state to state, and that is, it's going to be in ballots like in the state of California over Proposition 71, which gave $3 billion for stem cell research. People got together at the community level and said, we want this. And end runs around that by Camelot-style bodies in Washington are not going to happen. So bioethicists are going to either have to adjust to a new reality in which states figure prominently or just adjust themselves to being irrelevant.
One of the issues that you talk about, again, I went to blogbioethics.net for some ideas about things that we should be talking about, and there's just so many things there. But one of the things that's there today is the abortion Plan B article about the issue of pharmacists not wanting to prescribe morning after pills. And I think this touches on another one of the themes that I see coming out of the contemporary biopolitics that I've written about in my book, Citizen Cyborg, which is the notion that the bioethics discussion around personhood versus the notion that you have human dignity from conception to death, that this is one of the dimensions of polarization of public opinion that's moving from the academe and increasingly being part of public consciousness because of the abortion debate. And basically, it is entirely consistent. I don't see how you can get around it if you really believe that the fertilized embryo is a person that you would not want to have the morning after pill. And so, you know, people have pointed out that this is a loser for the Republicans, but it's one of these important issues that's crystallizing public opinion around personhood. Do you agree with that?
I absolutely agree, and I think the argument that you make in Citizen Cyborg is right on the money more generally. I just think it's clear, frankly, you've latched on to a fact that has missed a number of political analysts as they planned campaigns for liberals and moderates. And that is, we saw in the Schiavo vote when people showed up in the middle of the night, Democrats, to vote to subpoena Terri Schiavo in a persistent vegetative state or to take some kind of action to protect her. There's a new reality here, and it's the one that you described. It's a reality in which ideas that haven't been carefully examined are applied willy-nilly. I mean, the notion that we can get an intelligent stem cell debate out of the abortion debate is incredible. In many of these cases, the idea that these are real embryos begs all sorts of questions. The idea that this research destroys life more than freezing embryos generally. I mean, if we were to actually try to make rational policy out of the arguments that are being made by real conservatives against stem cell research and so on, we'd end up with a pretty incredible public policy in which science would pretty much all but stop.
Well, you pointed out recently that Pope Benedict had actually written that if you regressed an adult stem cell to the point where it could become any kind of tissue in the body, that it then had to be considered an embryo that could become a human being, and therefore you wouldn't be able to use it, which basically means that where most adult stem cell research is trying to go and where most Christian right folks are supporting adult stem cell research, it wouldn't be within Pope Benedict's ethical purview. I mean, he wouldn't consider it ethical.
That's my favorite paradox. I think that I actually think that there's some traction in making that point, because I think people are beginning to understand this difference between adult and embryonic stem cells as the decisive issue. So conservatives who are not clear about where they're going to vote on stem cells or whom they're going to support or what kind of activities they're going to fund, they point to adult stem cells as a viable option as though they know what they're talking about when they've been brainwashed basically by the argument that adult stem cell research is on a par with embryonic stem cell research. I mean, the only thing those two kinds of research have in general in common is that the words stem and cell are in them both. I mean, in general, immunological work with adult stem cells, even the work that's done for cancer and for diabetes, really these are completely different uses of cells, even different cells. What's been proposed by members of the President's Bioethics Council, by individual Catholics, and even members of the laity, is something that really doesn't make sense in the abortion policy that they defend. And where we're headed then is that this kind of argument that's been trotted around by conservatives to the effect that it would be better to try adult cells first is going to implode. Because the adult cells that people want to try are cells that have been regressed to the point that they count as an embryo if a clone counts as an embryo. So, you know, there's no solution there.
I'm speaking with Glenn McGee, and I'm going to do the second half of his CV at this point, which is that he's the author of many books, including The Perfect Baby, which is a bestseller, Who Owns Life, Pragmatic Bioethics, and most recently Beyond Genetics, which is oriented towards the younger reader who's trying to figure out what to do with their genetics in the future. So a very practical guide. You can also read Glenn's day-to-day work at blog.bioethics.net and in the Journal of the American Journal of Bioethics. Another of the topics in blog, bioethics.net, you're talking about the sheep chimera that are out in Nevada, and this follows on a number of chimera articles that have been in the news recently about the proposed mouse with human neurons out in Stanford and so on and so forth. One of the issues that really I was so delighted by that you published out of American Journal of Bioethics was an issue focused on the chimera question, and basically a lot of the reviewers and commentators in that issue concluded that chimeras were not a big deal. So tell us, what's your position on chimeras? When should chimeras not be ethical? What would you like to see as a restriction on chimera research?
Well, a chimera is a mixing. There's several different ways in which this word is used, but the mixing of material, typically cellular material, so cells of one kind of organism with another, and typically when chimera is discussed in the media, they mean human cells with some other form of life. So it could be animal, it could be plant for that matter. Chimeras that are commonly present in medicine include the production of all human insulin, right, which a mixture of human and bacterial DNA. But when people talk about chimeras in the context of this sheep research, which I think frankly will end up being as big a story as Shibo over the next coming weeks, what they're pointing to is the idea that you can implant a great deal of human material into an animal and produce an animal that shares enough traits with human as to invoke the Greek mythical concept of chimera, which is, you know, a human, part human, part animal. I've forgotten the combination. What is it? Do you know, Jay? It's a goat human. I forget, but in any event, it's a complicated part human thing that belies the idea of the real human. And, you know, sheep with half a human's brain in Nevada, the conservatives could not have ordered a better controversy to push against stem cell research. It is interesting, frankly, that a number of those who are investigating this research have as their standard the idea that they won't do something that creates an animal that looks human or thinks in a human way. So at Stanford, when they're producing mice that have a great number of human brain cells, the rule that they put out there for themselves once they start this work is that if the mice begin to act human in some way, they'll stop. That's freaky, you know? I mean, the people look at that and say, what have you done to the special nature of the human? And what a number of authors who've spent a lot of time thinking about this have concluded is that while that's an interesting kind of point, it's the sort of thing that Leon Cass writes about. That is, it's something that seems repugnant, and where there's repugnance, one ought to move slowly. The real issues, in my view, are about whether or not we should have safety research so that we don't accidentally produce, you know, an Ebola. Where there's wisdom is of science, in my view, not a kind of simple wisdom of feeling.
Well, you also mentioned that the National Academy of Sciences has just released stem cell research guidelines that they'd like to see adopted, and one of the guidelines was that they don't want to have chimera research.
Indeed. Well, it doesn't quite go that far, but it definitely suggests that there should be restrictions on chimeric research, and that those restrictions would include some of the sorts of... I'm not sure that those guidelines would actually stop, for example, this newly publicized research in Nevada involving, you know, hearts and livers from humans in sheep. But it would definitely, the fact of these rules that prohibit some chimeric work, or rather would suggest that states prohibit some work in producing part human, part animal creatures, the existence of those rules will make for an interesting public debate about what we can and can't make. And, you know, it's, again, it's tailor-made for folks who are scared already of biotechnology to raise a flag and say these scientists are off their chain.
You saw recently that Stuart Newman, who's a longtime associate of Jeremy Rifkin, they had been filing for many years to get the U.S. Patent Office to a rule on whether they could patent a humanzee, a half human, half chimpanzee. And the Patent Office recently, just in February, I believe, rejected their patent finally on the grounds that it was too human. And that's, getting back to this personhood argument, that's always struck me as absolutely the wrong direction to go for this debate, because basically it's not, you know, if we put human neural tissue into a sheep and that sheep talks to us and has the mentation of a human being, I don't care how human you decide it is. What I want to know is whether it should have rights on the basis of the fact that it can talk to us. Is it? Do you think that that's a direction that we could possibly go, or is it always going to be trapped in this human life debate? What is human and what's not human?
Well, I don't know. I'm not sure. I mean, practically speaking, the wisdom of the Patent Office is not something anybody's ever going to appeal to. I mean, they've gone in all the wrong directions recently on biotechnology. How they understand the patenting of genes is kind of unusual. Stem cells, basically all of that material is now patented and been ruled essentially as patentable. And this most recent decision that you mentioned on protecting humanness, that is, this a number of different patent decisions have gave precedent to their ruling that you ought not allow a patent on something that is in any way human. But this is all—it's all crazy. I don't want the Patent Office doing metaphysics. But what ought we do? The human Z, it seems to me, should never have made it as far as it did, because it didn't pass a central patent test. It had no—there was no evidence whatsoever that they could have done that. And so, you know, in order to produce that there is, one of the things you have to prove in a patent application is that there's utility. And you can't show utility, it's not a high bar, but you can't show utility, as best I understand it, without demonstrating how the thing would work. And for a creature that's transgenic, so across two species in a real sense, the human Z puts a pretty heavy burden on the investigator. So why the Patent Office didn't just wad it up and throw it back at him, I don't know. But it handed a football to Jeremy Rifkin, who is at this point the best ally the conservatives could have, about an issue that I think is sort of philosophically fairly simple. The human Z is, as you point out, a question about animal rights at bottom. So the question of whether you're protecting it from itself or from us comes down to its mentation and cognition, and doesn't have any, not only because it doesn't exist, but because if it were to be structured in the way that was described in their patent application, it would not rise to the level of being able to advocate for itself, even in you know, in theory.
Glenn, we have to have you back many, many times, but you're the editor of the American Journal of Bioethics, and you blogmast at the blog.bioethics.net, and chief of the Office of Bioethics for the State of New York, and the author of many books, including most recently Beyond Genetics, and I really appreciate you coming on the show today.
Well, I'm a big fan. Thanks, Jay.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts with me, Dr. J, you can contact me at jhughes@changesurfer.com. That's jhughes@changesurfer.com. Or you can read my Change Surfing columns at betterhumans.com, or check out the collaborative Cyborg Democracy blog I participate in at cyborgdemocracy.net. Or you can read my new book, Citizen Cyborg. For more details about Citizen Cyborg, visit cyborgdemocracy.net. At the Change Surfer website, you can find past and future shows archived in streaming MP3, thanks to the AInfos Radio Project. So educate, agitate, and organize, and I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.